Welcome to you all here at summer school. Some of you would have been to summer school before, some of you would probably not have been to summer school before. So welcome to all of you. My name is Claire Kelly, I'm one of the coordinators of the program. But I'm not going to say much more, except to introduce to you Craig Sodine, who is our Deputy Vice Chancellor of Transformation here at GCT, and who is going to introduce our speakers, our artists, who will be with you for the rest of the week. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Professor Sodine.
Thanks very much, Claire. So, as Claire says, anything that we say here isn't going to be able to remotely begin to give you a sense of what's coming. So, you're in for a treat. And so, thank you all very much for being here this afternoon and agreeing to go on this journey, Adam and his colleagues. I've been very fortunate to be pretty close to Adam when he's choreographed and played this kind of role. What he's doing here is a very particular act of mediation, if you like. And what he's essentially attempting to do is to bring the academy within reach of everyday popular culture, things that make particularly the city pump and beat to a kind of rhythm that I think many of us who are older have no sense of. And it's a really important job that he does. But he does it as a scholar. So he comes out of English and media studies, and he's currently an associate professor in film and media studies, and he's written prolifically in a very conventional medium about these issues of popular culture. But it's the way in which he's handled what is for him a really important bridge-building exercise between the generations, between aspects of the city, between ways in which people come to speak and express their sense of creativity and so on, that I really would like to commend to you. So thanks very much, Adam, for doing this, and I'm sure all of you are looking forward to it and saying to me, just go away, Adam's telling me. So, big welcome, and over to you, Adam.
Thanks, Professor Sodine. The pressure. Before we start, I think I should just introduce the artist who will be joining me in this journey. 20 years ago to this day, I became aware of the work of a group of prophets of the city, and the album, the third album, Agents, has got my attention. Was watching TV one day. I had seen them perform. I thought they were awesome as a live act. I liked it more than Black Noise at the time. Don't tell Emil that. But essentially, I wasn't really that captivated as I was in the moment when I saw a video called Understand Where I'm Coming From, that used so much prohibited art, you know, material, journalistic material, that it was evidence of police brutality in the townships that really made visible the fact that we were in a state of civil war. And the message was, be critical, citizens. Don't just go with messages to reconcile. Be wary of the national party. Be wary of the people you're negotiating with. And when you go and vote, bear this in mind. Be critical. And for this message, they got banned. Music without lyrics on it got banned. Like, this is the sort of situation. I'm watching this video, and I'm thinking, this will get banned. How soon it will get banned is another issue. Let me see if I can get this album before it gets pulled from stores. And I'm literally running around the city, from store to store, dealing with previous clerks, store clerks, getting hip hop, it's about getting stupid. Flavor of the month, you know, let it go, move on, do something else. 20 years later, I'm still writing about this. And one of the founding members is here with me today. He'll be my co-lecturer, DJ ADD, founder of Prophets of the City. Founder of Prophets of the City and Nasser Fadi Khan, currently one of the top 30 DJs internationally, top rated DJs internationally. We know of a number of DJ competitions, not exclusively hip hop, across a number of genres. Well traveled, possibly better known outside of South Africa than inside South Africa, which is a typical story for South African musicians of color. And then on my right, DJ Azul, our DJ for the day. He'll be joining us on the panel discussion on Age of Truth on Thursday. DJ Azul, the Neophytes. Star Trek is an MC, right? With the Neophytes. MC became a DJ before, became a DJ with the Gossip and he can't talk extensively with them in and outside of the country, and works in various hip-hop activist projects, youth development projects, along with DJ ADD, DJ E20, and then also the late Mr. Fat, Mr. Devious, a range of artists who've been active over the last 2 decades. So that's our crew. Thanks for joining me. DJ Lady D actually has an ear infection, so I'm going to invite him to take a seat. He's mic'd up with a lapel mic. And what I'm going to do is, for the purposes of today's lecture, I'm going to assume that you're undergraduate students and that you know very little about pop culture, about subculture, etc., etc. If you have your PhDs, if you're professors, my apologies. What you can do, once I've eased my way into this and I give you know, an opportunity to come in at key points. What you can do is, okay, enough of the 101, move it along, and we can go incredibly complex. We can go as complex as you want to go, as far as our brains would allow us to stretch. So, today's lecture is going to be about early hip-hop and the importance of black consciousness in the South African context. Well, not exclusively, but in the global, the US and South African context, specifically. And, let's start and talk about its origins. We know this already. Story of DJs in the South Bronx and the inner city of places like New York, in the South Bronx, starting up with house parties, block parties, etc., etc., spread to the West Coast, and so on and so on. But the story behind that is an important story to bear in mind. I'm not going to belabor this, but we are going to come back to this on Wednesday when we talk about gender politics in hip-hop. You're going to have to bear this point in mind. And the point is basically this. The context within which hip-hop artists were operating was one in which, you know, poverty in the inner city, in African-American neighborhoods, poverty was a real issue. And part of the reason for that is deindustrialization. But then also what some harsh critics might say, you know, the context within which a generation of people after the Black Panthers came to the failure of black nationalism, in other words. So Tupac's mother would have been a Panther. As black nationalism folds in on itself due to a number of complex reasons, a new sort of generation of people come out of that. So hip-hop comes out of that moment. And this is how Michelle Alexander describes it. She sort of brings home the sort of context within which these artists are operating. We see a context where, you know, the rise of the sort of the transition of one mode of capitalism to another, the rise of the sort of, excuse me. Yes, I'm nervous. I'll take a moment. So we see the sort of rise of neoliberal economics, the sort of new version of capitalism. What this means for people working in factories in places like Detroit is those factories are being shut down. They no longer have jobs. The jobs that they did were now being outsourced to places like China, India, etc., etc. So it happens with cars. It certainly is happening with information technology. It's an old story. It's 30, 40 years in the making. So we see all of this happening. So those inner cities, those cities that relied on a large labor pool, cheap labor pool, in places like Detroit, for example. there's nothing for them. There's absolutely nothing for them. So that's one part of it. So part economics, but the other part of it is we have sort of this conservative backlash, people supporting Republican policy as a sort of a backlash to the gains that the Democrats, the concessions that the Democrats have made to black liberation struggles, right? So you've got that backlash. So that's an important part. And what makes Reagan, I didn't even know much about Reagan as a kid. I was standard one, that's grade three, when Reagan was voted in, and I was like, oh. Didn't quite understand why, but I knew this was bad. He was a fabulous actor. What he was able to do is to sort of invoke racial stereotypes, invoke racial thinking without actually using racial language. So this is how we get Tea Party logic in contemporary America right now. We can have incredibly racist actions and discourses circulating in the public sphere, but no one's racist. You know, you can't actually, you know, it's not a clear-cut KKK cardboard stereotype of a racist in public spaces. So many of the stereotypes that you would see in gangster rap, the wealthy queen, the crack hoe, the pimp, all of those stereotypes you see in gangster rap gets validated, gets sort of taken up in the discourse of the rising Reagan era and the subsequent Bush era, Bush senior era. So this is sort of background to the story of hip hop. And the reason I'm bringing this up is partly because the elements, because of the elements of hip hop. And I'm going to stop for a minute and just ask these questions. Many people would disagree about this. Some people would say that hip hop is a philosophy and encompasses everything, it's a way of life. Others would say, no, it's just an art form. Others again would say, it's just music. In order to make light of this, I'm going to defer to Lady D at this point. Tell me if I should pass. Could you tell us a little bit about the five elements? And don't say knowledge itself first. In that order. Rapper, MC, B-boy, turntablism, and feel free to jump in when turntablism comes up. DJ Azul. Could you tell us a little bit about the five elements, starting with rap? You've got the mic.
Oh,
okay. Your mic up.
Okay. Facebook giving me my ears is busted. I thought Adams and I have mercy on me. Went to the medication brought up my system.
Oh, I think you're off. I think you're off. You're on the power pole.
We are here. We've been on statue of poppets. And how's that?
Okay.
Okay.
As I was saying, I thought he's going to have mercy on my soul and let all the medication brought on my system.
You can do it for now.
I'm going to give it a best shot. Ladies and gentlemen, I was born and raised in District 6. My family were amongst those who forcefully moved, or forced out of District 6. We were relocated into Mitchell's Plain. For me personally, I don't come from a political or activism background. It's through my journey with hip-hop, with music, with especially Prophets of the City, that kind of put me into that stream, if you want to call it that. I've never been a part of a political organization. I've never affiliated myself with any political organizations. So everything I've come through experience and sort of getting involved with hip-hop as a culture growing up. We start to learn that there's so many similarities in terms of what is happening in the US of A, because that's, of course, when we've been influenced by Fubina, you know, just to cut the long story short. So we could relate to the gang violence, we could relate to the poverty. As the years moved on, we could kind of relate to the political aspects, and we started to get a better understanding of the issues and the challenges that we face. So within hip-hop, it's said there's five major elements in no particular order. The MC, that's the rapper. The master of ceremonies, he or she. They are the persons that will get onto the mic, tell stories. Can either be fictional, it could be fantasy, it could be truth, it could be from an activism point of view. Then we get into the graph over there. Sorry, Adam,
no.
See you guys in a specific order, please.
They can flip backwards and forwards all the time.
It can go backwards, yeah. So it's the graph art, that's the graffiti art. And These artists, they tagged walls that were what we call it, hip hop pieces on the walls, or you could bomb the walls, or you could throw ups on the walls. It becomes very competitive, and it has its roots within the political environment, it has its roots within gang culture. For me, my encounters with graffiti was, sure, looking at all these really scary sort of illustrations on the walls, especially as a kid growing up in District 6, and looking at a lot of the characters in your community. And the one was this guy, he looked Asian. He had this traditional sort of Chinese hat on, and of course he had Tata pipe, and this gang was called the Mongrels, and we had the Cobra Kids, and we had the Fancy Boys, and what we've seen on the walls we normally used to see on the necks and the heads of so many characters. So learning, once again, the similarities between graph and its roots in the States and here in South Africa and how it's evolved, that was another, I would say, reason why a person started to get more intrigued and more deeper into hip-hop. So the one form, wild style, it's a very extreme style of graph writing. We'll certainly try and get some pics for you to see. I'm not sure if you have any of the slides now.
Oh no, I don't have anything lined up.
Okay. And this is normally, it's almost like a kind of code that writers put on the wall. It's got a lot of arrows, it's got a lot of curves, a lot of color. The writing is within the writing, within the writing, within the writing. And if you're a well-versed graffiti artist, you'll understand. So maybe one writer might be sending a message, say for instance, a writer from Woodstock will be sending a message to a crew in Goods, which is like, we put it in the form of wild style. Or you could be communicating with your affiliates elsewhere in the world, could be America, could be in the East, could be in Europe. So this is the depth of aerosol art. And then when it comes to throw-ups, this is where writers, if they have crews, or there's a heavy sense of competition between the crews, they'll just throw up over each other's pieces and they'll do this really nasty looking tags and this big sort of bubble style plain letters. And then of course the tags, that's the very quick one. I remember the tag because that nearly got myself locked up, including another two of my friends in Mitchell's Plain back in 1986. And this story kind of goes, we were out there, had no issues, no involvement, no sense of what was happening politically. All we wanted to do was bomb the walls and bring some color to Mitchell's Plain. And then we were putting up this piece called Fresh. And normally we used to write up Fresh in a very sort of distinct graph style. And at the end it would be three dots. And the cops wrapped up and we couldn't finish the dots in time. And they practically had their guns pointed at us. The one friend managed to do some somersaults and crazy things over a fence of a school yard. This is on Morgan State Road in Mitchell's Plain. My one friend managed to get away, unfortunately, myself and the other guy. We were put in the police van because they said we were communists. We couldn't finish the dots and it looked like it was CCC. That's one of the wildest rides that you can imagine. In the back of the police van, and they made sure that they shake us around. We were flying all over the place. And the real, I would say the sad part of the story is, we were taken to Mitchell's Plain police station, and bearing in mind, we're kind of going into the state of emergencies right now where all these buffles and caspers and the army used to come in. And it was about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and we actually had to walk home because I lived down in Lentegeer, which is like a 20, half an hour walk from Mitchell's Plain town center. So we could walk past all these gang territories. And normally boys come from the one side of Mitchell's Plain, you can't just freely walk or operate and just go as you please into other areas at that time of the night. And those were stages where gang activity was at the all-time high. So that's just a little bit of...
So that's perfect. So, many people who don't know much about graph would confuse it with gang graffiti. But it's actually the very opposite, isn't it? It operates in a different way.
I would say yes and no. It can be related to gang culture as well. because there's many gangsters that have embraced hip hop as a culture for whatever means they chose or choose. And unfortunately, we use the various art forms, or they use the various elements to convey their messages as well. So they kind of bring, if you want to call it, their swag or their flavor or their interpretation and their sort of thinking into the culture. So there is that sense, you know, of, if you want to call it, the culture now being diluted by those forces as well. The same as it is, you know, in so many other.
Like the Tupac mural in Manenberg.
In Manenberg, that's a perfect example. The Art Livings, they put up this huge Tupac mural in Manenberg because they became fans of Tupac. And if you look at the Tupac had to say what he had to say, what he stood for, it was totally, I think, to a certain extent contradictory. But I think what turned him on was the fact that Tupac released songs called Hit 'Em Up. And this was like a diss that went out to East Coast rapper Biggie Smalls. And there was that kind of bred a huge East Coast, West Coast feud that practically went out across the world. And unfortunately, our communities were caught up in that as well, because now you had kids in the Woodstock area. They kind of went with the East Coast sort of gangs, because Biggie Smalls, he formed a group called Junior Mafias. So we had junior mafias in Woodstock that would go to war with the HRs and everyone else that were fans of West Coast, the rappers like Tupac Shakur and, you know, his clique. So unfortunately, you know, we got caught in the crossfire of all that madness as well.
Interesting. We'll come back to that issue when we talk about globalization and gender politics in relation to gangster. But for now, emceeing, do you want to talk to that, or shall I shoot to that myself?
You want emceeing?
Okay, so emceeing, there are many reasons, there are arguments for against the cultural imperialism thesis. Many people look at hip hop and the narrative that JDD just offered might have you thinking, oh well, you see, gangsters in Cape Town are imitating gangster rappers from the States, and it just validates the cultural imperialism thesis. People are just imitating what they see on MTV and BET. But the fact is, when it comes to MC, there are arguments for oral tradition being very much alive. The oral tradition that you get coming out of Africa inspired what happened in the diaspora. So by the time people, enslaved people, were taken from the west coast of Africa, they took with them various aspects of their culture and tradition, and oral culture and mythology is very much a part of that. I'm not going to dwell on this, but I do think you should check out Andy Louis Gates's Signify, The Signified Monkey, and the book Figures of Blood, because that, to me, when I was doing my MA research long ago, that was the bridge between my interest in oral poetry and performance poetry in the South African context and its a sort of, you know, tradition of protest culture and oratory informing this performance, that tradition meeting up with the oral culture of hip-hop. So there was already a lot of momentum here when it comes to the very sort of clever use, the double-coded use of language, playing with different dialects of languages, as well as the dominant, the hegemonic languages, English and Afrikaans, in the South African context. So already I'm seeing parallels between oral traditions in the South African, in the African context, and that of the US. And this is obviously what made a lot of sense to a lot of people who were already involved in, caught up in the state of emergency of apartheid repression. They would use any means they could to make sense of the reality and actually vocalize resistance, and just vocalize the creativity. So that's interesting, but we can come back to that in discussion time again. I'm rushing here to turntablism, and I'd like, is it possible for Azul to tell us a little bit about turntablism and the approach to what makes this hip hop? That's a good question. Bypassing the fact is good. Because of the game fiction.
It's okay. My turn tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, turntablism, the art of being a DJ. The art of being a hip-hop DJ, it's been quite a, I would say, very interesting journey, and one that's quite intense. And for me, the thing that really sort of captivated me was the fact that I never ever dreamed or imagined that a turntable or a phonograph could become a musical instrument, and the way people would use the black plastic to manipulate the sounds, completely mind-blowing. You know, the turntables and the phonograms were invented sort of, sure, if I stand to be corrected, it goes back as far as the 1910s and 20s. It's evolved from there. So many DJs have come through the various eras. There's been so many different sort of interpretations. And just the fact that hip-hop DJs, they kind of push the envelope when it comes to turntablism. And names such as Africa Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, DJ Kool Herc. A lot of people say the history goes back to Kool Herc, a DJ from originally from Jamaica. He's moved to the South Bronx, and he sort of brought the Jamaican form of DJ to the US. And these guys used to have these huge sound system battles where one crew would set up a sound system on one side of the park, and another crew would set up another sound system. And then these guys would go back and forth and try and battle each other to see who had the biggest sound system. And there would be different sort of Jamaican chants that would go over the music. And then DJs such as Grandmaster Flash, Buck Starsky, there's a huge list of names you know, that we can throw at you, but we're going to try and fast forward and go through this as quickly as possible. People said that a DJ called Grand was a Theodore. He stumbled upon scratching. Now that came to be, the music was playing loud in this room. His mom came rushing through the door, and she was like, put that rubbish off, blah, blah, blah. And she was going on, and he stopped the record in his headphones, and while his mom was busy, you know, having a few words with him, he was busy queuing up the record in his headset and moving the record back and forth. And that's exactly the sound that he was listening to. And once his mom had left the room, he immediately jumped into that. And that is something that he kind of landed on, and he developed that. Then we have another story from a gentleman known as Grandmaster Flash. And his story is slightly different to Grandmaster Theodore. So unfortunately, we have this point now which is debatable as to who invented the scratch. Grandmaster Flash, his story is, he locked himself up in his room for 3 years. He studied electronics. He managed to find a way to put a headphone switch and other little functions onto the sound mixer. And through this, he developed certain methods. After spending 3 years developing those techniques in his room, he brought it out into the park jams. He used to have a lot of functions in the park jams. And apparently after his first gig, everybody booed him because it sounded like he was messing up the music. People didn't quite understand him, but it evolved from there. So fast forward through to the 90s through to 2000, this is when turntablism sort of evolved. There was various championships held around the world. So we're just going to demonstrate some of the techniques very quickly. So we're taking recorded music and we're practically manipulating it. So we have the turntable, we have the mixer, and these days with all the new technology, we use laptops, it's very fancy record boxes, and we can pack all our effects units, and there's a whole lot of other really wonderful things that we can do with this. So we're just going to take it through some of the basics. DJ Azul, if you could just play the song rather than a scratch. That's sort of become the traditional sound that turntablers, the DJs, have used through the ages. And by manipulating this, we have names to certain techniques. So this is what's known as the baby scratch. And now we can evolve the baby scratch, and we can turn it into something known as the military scratch by incorporating the crossfader. And now we'll move on to a scratch known as the Transformer scratch. And this, yes, ladies and gentlemen, it was inspired by the movie Transformers. That before the movie, there was a cartoon series in the 80s, I think it was, and Will Smith's DJ Jazzy Jeff, he's the guy that made this technique popular around the world. I think think we're going to leave it there. So that kind of gives you an idea of turntablism. So we'll take those sounds, we'll then put that on top of, we'll put it on top of other tracks as various technical mixing techniques built into that as well. Excuse me, he's hustling me to jump on the deck. So then, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do, is it okay if we do a 2 minute jam session?
It is okay.
So we'll just demonstrate some of the techniques. You're going to see some funny finger movements, like the sound of the transform. We'll be chopping it into more notes. Arena. Now we're going to get a little bit fancy, you know, now we're going to start to strut our stuff and show off a little bit and show people, oh man, you just don't have to do this the normal way, you can do things like we did in Graf, we can throw down the wild style way, or we could do like we do in MCing, you can now start incorporating syllables, like in the b-boy element, we can now start throwing in flares and it can become really complex.
Thing in a minute, but what I want you to bear in mind is this is a commodity. You go into a store, you buy this. The vinyl is a commodity. That's a commodity, the computer. Much like the aerosol cans, you go into a hardware store, you buy the commodity. What are they doing with the commodity? They're reinventing what it means, what this thing means. So you use the spray can to spray paint the car, your furniture, etc., etc. They go to public space and they claim that public space. What is the context within which we're operating? The rise of Reaganism, right? The collapse of the inner city, deindustrialization. Basically, people of color being dislocated from the land, being disenfranchised. They might have the vote in theory, but the prisons are filling up, public spending on healthcare, on education, safe parks for kids to play, all of these things are going down. And at the same time, there are theories that, you know, intelligence has flooded the streets with crap to diffuse the black nationalist movement, to diffuse the black panther. So all of this stuff is going down. People are dislocated. So you need to actually find a way to reclaim public space. So Graf artists are reclaiming public space, Afrika Bambaataa, DJ Kool Herc, and all of these artists are using these commodities, they're speaking through them, and they're producing messages that are counter-discursive, they're counter-hegemonic. They're reinventing what the word vinyl means. Much like the MCs would reinvent the language, the slave master's language, English, you would repurpose it. You claim it, and you subvert it. Okay? And this is where double-coded modes of speech comes from. Parallel discursive universes, this is what Henry Louis Gates would call it. Whereas the Americans would say Henry Louis Gates. Henry Louis Gates. And this is what it means. So the sign vinyl might mean something in mainstream hegemonic discourse, but to a hip-hop artist, it gets retooled, repurposed, it gets reinvented. So this is how you have these parallel discursive universes. And aesthetic definitions also get redefined, because you might have DJs coming into a studio, which traditionally would have worked with white male rock artists, those artists would get upset because now you have these engineers, these MCs, these producers coming in,
and they're killing the equipment, they're destroying it. You're going to blow our system. Yeah? You're going to go blow our PA system. So this is an old story. These hip-hop artists are screwing up our stuff. There's too much rupture, there's too much noise, there's too much bass. It's distorted. Oh, you know, so it's an aesthetic battle, but it's actually political. So who defines what is aesthetically beautiful, right? Who defines what you may do in public space? Sorry, let me go back to Jack. So bombing walls, tagging, etc., whether it was the apartheid context, whether it was the South Bronx in 1978, the same issue. Whose space is this? Are we not citizens? Can we claim the space to be creative, etc., to be fully human, right? So this is the story. This is what informs it. So you reinvent this commodity. Dick Ebbich would say subcultures are counter-hegemonic. Why are they counter-hegemonic? How does it happen? They do it through style. They speak through commodities. They reinvent them. And of course, if that is true, commodities are commodities. They can be co-opted commercially. So bear that in mind. We'll come back to that. B-boy. We don't have a... do you want to... No. Who did you B-boy?
My ears are
not with that ear infection. That's not. So B-boys do the same thing. They're intertextual. Now think about it. What they did was incredibly intellectual. They've got a backing track. It could be sampled from a million places. They've got some vinyl with tracks up here, and it's incredibly intellectual. There's so many texts that they could bring in. A beat from here, a sample from wherever, something from a movie, something from a TV thing, something that is recorded live and incorporated. A whole range of things. So this is the ultimate postmodern approach to making music. It's live, it's ephemeral. It can't always be exactly reproduced in the same way, but then again, maybe it can. There's always that sort of difference, that slippage, right? So B-boys do the same thing with their bodies, and they reference all of these intertextual things. That if Ramon of Prophets of the City were here, he would say that a lot of B-boys were influenced by manga, cartoons, right? By kung fu, by science fiction, by a range of things, not necessarily thought of as dance. So they invent what dance means. What does it mean to move with your body, to speak through your body? Incredibly intertextual, but also appropriates that sign, dance, and introduces alternate meanings. So which brings us to the question of knowledge of self. And I'm going to refer to Lady D at this point because the quote that I'm about to offer you is actually from Prophets of the City, so we'll get it in the founding memory to talk about this. So what drives hip-hop's early messages, many people would say it was knowledge of self, all of these different elements. It could have been skateboarding, it could have been anything, but the thing that makes hip-hop is knowledge of self. It's the glue that brings all of these elements together. So what does this mean? So on one level, they're drawing on Eastern philosophies, but the most tangible philosophy that they're drawing on is black consciousness. Those black nationalist narratives from the previous generation still continue to influence them. So the late Amiri Baraka, for example, definitely would be counted as an influence on MCs. Gil Scott-Heron, LKJ in the UK, a range of poets, dub poets, performance poets, whatever you want to call them, influencing this emerging MCs and DJs, etc. So what is it then? There's a sort of an attempt to reintroduce, to challenge colonial thinking on what it means to be black. So the first sort of most obvious US example would be Public Enemies, Fight the Power. And if you haven't seen the film Doing the Right Thing by Spike Lee, it's a staple. Here you have the message coming through loud and clear about how hip-hop is used to disrupt a space, to claim it, to make noise, to disturb people, to disturb the peace, literally, on a sonic level, that to rupture, but then on an ideological level as well, to challenge, in this instance, what it means to be American. What does American nationalism mean? That's a white supremacist narrative. And what are we going to do? What are we going to do to drive that point home? We're going to take some of the most sacrosanct icons from that time, from the 80s, and we're going to violate them for you. We need to appropriate them. So, my favorite part from the song, Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant shit to me, you see. Straight up racist, that sucker was simple and plain. Motherfuck him and John Wayne. Okay, I'm gonna stop there. Why Elvis, the king of rock and roll, JDD, why Elvis? Why fuck Elvis?
I think because of Elvis' status at the time. And a lot of people, when you think of Elvis, you think that Elvis was the person that actually, he was actually being credited or elevated to a point where people actually believed that he was the founder or the creator of rock and roll music, whereas those that have been there, you know.
Chuck Berry.
Exactly. You know, all those artists, they weren't really given the platform or the credit that they deserve. So I think that Public Enemy, Chuck Berry specific, kind of went for the highest profile artists that the world can sort of recognize. And by using personalities such as Elvis, you are practically sending a global shockwave, you know, throughout.
Exactly. Are you not a patriot?
Yeah, and I mean, not just people in the US can identify with Elvis. I mean, my mom, massive Elvis fan, made sure that I was in so much trouble. So much trouble. So I mean, that's just took my take on why we got the Elvis.
So cultural appropriation is what they're speaking to. At the time, perhaps, not many scholars would have been speaking about Elvis in relation to arguments about cultural appropriation, but that's what it was, many people would say today. That, you know, the way to ensure the crossover appeal of black cultural expression is to have a white artist step up and embrace it and take it to that white majority paying audience. That's how you make things go mainstream. So, rhythm and blues artists, the definition of music genres is how it happened. White artists doing this thing were placed in the rock and roll section. Black artists doing this thing were ghettoized in the rhythm and blues section. Right? That's one way. There are many other categories. If you go into music stores, and even today, it's interesting to see what gets classified as just music, rock and roll, pop, and what gets classified as world music. I'm like, what the hell is world music? Am I world music? Are you? Because you're not in the States. What is this, right? So there's a whole turf war there. Cultural appropriation is one part of it. Elvis, another signifier of the proud American century, glossing over the genocide of indigenous Americans, how this, you know, American Republic was established off of basically genocide. Never mind cultural appropriation of land, killing off people en masse, etc., etc. And there's scholarship obviously today that acknowledges this story. So this, the entire genre of Westerns is fundamentally racist. So when Johnny Depp goes off and does, you know, the Lone Ranger, dressed up as an indigenous person with his feathers and his paint, I'm like, I used to really like Johnny Depp. But this doesn't, you know, not quite what's eating Gilbert Grape, far from it. So, what then informs Chuck D's thinking? It's black consciousness thinking. And I'm deliberately not offering you a Malcolm X or Angela Davis or whoever else quote. I want you to alert you to the fact that local artists like Prophets of the City, Black Noise, etc., etc., they were reading Biko as well as Marcus Garvey and a lot of other people from other parts of the world. This is how Biko speaks about black consciousness. Merely by describing yourself as black, you have started toward a road to emancipation. You have committed to fight against all those forces that seek to use your blackness as a stamp that marks you out as a subservient being. And you can tell that he probably was reading Frantz Fanon, I think. Oh, no, I don't offer one. Let me skip that. No, do I have a Frantz Fanon quote? I think I have it later. I don't know what I was thinking. So, let me just say this quickly. A lot of my thinking on South African hip-hop was informed by work of sociolinguists, and one of them is in this room, in actual fact, I'm too nervous to say. Another one would be Kay McCormick, who did a lot of research on language, the use of Afrikaans and English, non-standard dialects of Afrikaans and English in District 6. Right? District 6, for those of you who know, there's this classic song of album Funk Flow by Prophets of the City with the BDDBs, rapping on a song called I Remember District 6, and all he does is he calls his childhood in District 6, the moment before everything gets taken away from him. To me, it's one of the best songs ever produced in the 90s. And this is the research that Cameron McCormick does to sort of validate the dialects of people spoken in those spaces, to record them, because they're literally not just physical spaces are being obliterated, but the modes of speech, the customs, the traditions, the history, are also, those things are also obliterated. So museums like District 6 Museum are vital in capturing that moment, but also certain kinds of hip hop, like POC's I Remember District 6 classic song. And what they do, what Crofts of the City are doing, through their use of the non-standard dialects of English and Afrikaans, largely Afrikaans, but not exclusively, is to claim what it means to be black in Afrikaans, to claim it. Yes, colored is an identity, but colored is a social construction like white and black, right? The sign colored was used to construct a narrative of different kinds of people, people who would not think of themselves as black, so that we may divide and rule the country. Let's co-opt a set of people as colored so that they don't unite with the broader category of black people. In other words, so they don't buy into Steve Biko's way of thinking about blackness. Blackness is an ideological statement more than a statement that is founded in biologically essentialist thinking on identity. Right? So he's rejecting essentialism. Essentialism is making a political claim. Dimitri Erasmus' own work rejects biologically essentialist understandings of race and language as well. And she talks about race as social construction. And a lot of my research taps into Dimitri's thinking on racial identity as well. So this brings us to POC. POC uses Afrikaans. He's largely thought of as a signifier of Hamness, right? Of being the sons of Ham, of being colored, the mark of shame. We are tainted, half-bloods. Think about all the epithets now. It just goes downhill. Go all Tea Party on racial identity. They take that and they say, we're going to take that. We're not going to reject Afrikaans. That's who we are. But we're going to mash that up with black consciousness thinking. Colored is a kind of black. We're black and we speak Hamtal. Do you have a problem with that? Apologies for offending you, but this is who we are. This brings us to the song Black Thing. Do you have any chance of underlined that?
Yes. 10 minutes.
10 minutes. I think, do you want to talk to this? Should I read it out to you? I know this is probably Shane's lyrics. You probably wrote it, but I'm sure you remember. You also have a verse in here,
yeah.
I think. Do you want to talk to the thinking on this? This is from an album called Funk Flow. And should I just read it quickly? The term colored is a desperate case of how the devil's divided us by calling us a separate race. Line up. They call me colored, said my blood isn't pure, but gee, I'm not lacking insecurity. I'm going to stop there because Shane is much better at this than me. Do you want to speak to that? Do you remember this at all? No recollection.
That's how you can go in there.
I'll cut that. So basically, you know, the each one teach one ethos of the time, thanks to the United Democratic Front, the activism on the ground.
Excuse me, can I just pause for a second?
Yeah.
What this is going to take a minute. One of the reasons why we felt very strong about writing that particular song in that particular manner as well is because we used to receive a lot of sort of harsh remarks and criticism from our own communities, our own families as well, you know.
going through this transformation and kind of being more aware, you know, of your surroundings, the circumstance, and having a better understanding of the history. You know, it's something that I was completely oblivious to, completely ignorant. Shaheen was more political, politically minded than me, you know, because he was on the SRC, he used to join all the rallies and all these things. From my perspective, is the typical brother that grew up on the Cape Flats. I do what young boys did on the Cape Flats, you know. That's not many of those things, that's what we would call it hip hop dumbish, you know. So my intention and my motivation was slightly different as well. So kind of finding myself on this consciousness political path, it's something that I didn't quite understand. We didn't sit in the room and we didn't say, this is the formula, this is the lyrics, I'm reading this book or I've uncovered this. Everything, it came from, I would say, it came from a very sort of honest space, whether we were contradicting ourselves at the time, or maybe we made sense, or maybe we didn't make sense. Just from my perspective, once again, I just felt that we needed to do something like this, and I needed to kind of tell my community this is exactly how I feel, you know, being put in this position, and now you're uncovering all this new information, and if you look at the politics, and if you look at the social condition at the time, we received a lot of criticism, you know, from our own communities.
So people who self-identified as colored and didn't buy this whole black consciousness thing, why are you calling me black, I'm colored? What's that about?
Because of the whole divide and conquer rule, you know, and our deeply rooted segregation, you know, was in the country, so he's, you know, through politics, through religion, through traditions and all those type of things. So for a colored boy to call himself black, it's like brah. Just here, dark in the room, you know. So that was the attitude. Who can say that it's a kafir? You know, that was the attitude. You don't quite understand what we're trying to say. You don't quite get to understand what we're trying to say. And at that point in time, trying to communicate with those in your immediate circles was extremely difficult because you could understand the National Party had such a grip, you know, on our communities. And if you look at the history in terms of how we've been conditioned, you know, it just doesn't come on from 10 years, 20 years, we're going down to hundreds of years, you know, with influence coming in from other sort of nations that have perfected the art of the art of subduing people through the ages, you know. So these are the pieces that we are left to pick up, and this is, you know, it's created a lot of confrontation and conflict on so many levels, and that's kind of what led to this.
And that concludes that section. I think you said it much better than me, straight from the horse's mouth. So basically, challenging internalization, the way people internalize apartheid thinking about identity. What's cool for me, I mean, this song's in English, but a lot of, actually, it's kind of in the non-standard dialect of English. I mean, yucking isn't an English word. What does yuck mean? What does it mean to yuck your insecurity, by the way?
Yuck, it depends on which context to use that. You know, yuck means if you're nicely dressed, you know, like today, for instance, I'm gejuck. This is my best attire. So I'm like, the brute is slightly just a yucky because a professor from that's a yucky move. You know, so it's that kind of attitude. I'm in there, I'm going to do it. Or if you use it in a different context, you could say, yo, my bro, he was no net gejuck. It means that somebody overpowered you, you know, or somebody conned you, or somebody persuaded you to do or say something against your will. So it totally depends, you know, in which context you use it.
At this point, any questions at this point? This is a good time to actually have voices coming in from the floor. One at the back.
Yes, thank you for this session. First and foremost, I appreciate the diversity in the room. I've been coming here for August, and very few, there was a lot of bias in the room, and I appreciate the diversity. But I wanted to ask the artist, what do you see as the biggest threat to hip-hop activism? Because both in the States, we made a lot of reference to the US, and in South Africa, what do you see as the biggest threat to hip-hop in both worlds right
now? I feel that the biggest threat to hip-hop and the activism aspect of hip-hop is practically ignorance, I would say. And I think it starts with the individual. You have to be willing to go out there and stand your ground, and you have to be willing to go and convey a message. And you must be willing to be able to be a part, if you want to call it a movement that might be sidelined. Because in this day and age, it's very, on the one end, there's positives and there's negatives. The one positive is we now have technology, and we have the internet, and now we can communicate. The other aspect is politics. It's so much more, it's a very sort of difficult minefield to navigate through, and we are faced with so much, especially when it comes to youth. So their priorities are elsewhere, you know. So I think those are some of the great challenges that we have to deal with as well. And if we look at mass media, and we look at all these options, you know, all these things that kids are faced with, we look at all the advertisements that our youth are being bombarded with on a day-to-day basis, the priorities have kind of shifted, you know. So if you're looking at let's say, a young person, the day you're hanging out in the mall, you with a cool crowd, the cool kids, you're on your phone, you're tweeting, you're doing whatever the case may be. So you're kind of stuck in that sort of, if you want to call it, you're stuck in that realm. So to be able to identify and come out of that, it's a very difficult task and challenge. Whereas in the previous years, you could say, you know, I know exactly who the enemy is, you know. That's him, okay, he's got the gun, he's got the casket, he laid down the laws, and I can identify him. So these days, it's extremely difficult, so that's just my personal take. But I feel it starts with the individual, and how you internalize that, and what you are prepared to do, and how far you are prepared to go with this journey or with this course. And there's a lot of, it comes with a lot of pressure, it's not easy. There was a lot of people that took the activism role, but unfortunately they fell by the wayside. You know, it's a lot of pressure that comes with it. So for me, it's all about the individual.
There is more on that, especially, well, tomorrow and then Wednesday as well. My watch might be fast. I think we've got 4 more minutes. So what I do want to do is create a link for those of you who are not, you know, staying for the rest of the week. I want to create a link with tomorrow's lecture quickly and just sort of bring it together. So what we've been talking about through the refusal to be interpolated as colored and identified with black consciousness ideology is basically talking about gestures of refusal here, challenging hegemonic discourses. And I think the best example, the best link would be Francois Noon in Black Skins, White Marks, who talks about the way in which his experience as an Algerian coming to France, walking the streets of Paris, having to negotiate racial interpolation in its crudest form, the way in which a racist discourse objectifies you, reduces you to an object amongst objects. And this idea is this sort of consciousness of the way in which the colonizer actually views you, sees you, creates sort of a split, a fragmentation of the subject, you would argue. I'm being very, very crude here. There's more about this in Static, my second book, a free download. You don't have to spend a cent. Download it. Google it. Static by me, you know, you, me. What I do there is I create a link to Dubois, double consciousness. The idea of measuring yourself by the tape of the colonial master. And this is the best, one of the coolest quotes. This quote, followed closely by this quote, is one of the nicest things for me. It's a peculiar concept. It's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. What POC does is they refuse that. I refuse to measure myself by your tape. I will not live my life according to your standards. I do not seek your approval to be validated as a full human being. Right? The terms are mine. You'll do this on my terms. That's what made Public Enemy and POC in their time, made them scary. Right? There was a lot of media hoo-ha, mainstream media. I'm not just talking about Fox. Did Fox exist 20 years ago? The way they were vilified. Of course, Flavor Flav didn't help, and he just gave them a lot of ammo. But the sort of militant message was positioned as militant, as aggressive, but coming for us. The black pedal,
right? That kind of militant message, assertive message was characterized as militant. That's how interpolation works, right? You position people through discourses. So you're not an assertive person looking to be respected as a full human being, right? You're militant, you're aggressive, right? You're the angry black man in the room, okay? In other words, you're creating a lot of noise. There's that word again, noise, rupture, breaking the PA. Trisha Rose, in 1994, I thought I was going to be the first person to look at POC's work and look at Public Enemy's work and recognize Dick Hebridge's arguments about subculture. Then she publishes this book called Black Noise. And I'm like, black noise? Like as in Emile's black noise? What's going on here? And I'm reading this book, I'm like, she's quoting Dick Hebridge. I thought I was going to be the first to publish using Dick Hebridge and making the link. So she says, quote, you know, drawing on Hebridge, it's a book called Subculture, the Meaning of Style. Style can be used as a gesture of refusal or as a form of oblique challenge to structures of domination. Hip-hop artists use style as a form of identity formation that plays on class distinctions and hierarchies by using commodities to claim the cultural terrain or space. Right? And this is Hebridge himself. Hebridge says, subcultures represent noise, literally. Interference in the orderly sequence which leads from real events and phenomena to the representation of the media. So from the actual event to its representation of the media, they come in and they actually sample that media, appropriate it, deconstruct it, and produce a counter message. That's what they do linguistically through the appropriation of public spaces, graph artists or b-boys, b-boying in public spaces, or as MCs, etc., etc. Right now you have, in places like Oakland, b-boys performing in public spaces and people recording it. And that is the protest. And the cops, let's see how quickly it takes for the cops to come along and harass these black men dancing on the sidewalk. It still is vital. So as much as people talk about hip-hop's commodification, MTV, etc., etc., on the streets, hip-hop is still a vehicle to appropriate space to make political statements, as well as aesthetic ones. So, as we get to time, subculture speaks through noise, right? It interrupts our sense of what is normal, contradicts myths of consensus about what is normal, right? And if it's true that subculture speaks to commodities, if it's true that it appropriates signs and commodities, etc., then the question is, if it does so, can it be co-opted? Which comes back to your question. And the answer is, yes, it can be co-opted. It is being co-opted, as other kinds of subcultures have been co-opted, commercially and ideologically. And that's what I wanted to talk about a bit more on Wednesday. Tomorrow, I want to really talk about this. Hip-hop in South Africa specifically, and set up, for those of us who remember the 80s and remember other kinds of cultural expression during that time, I want to just sort of show you one or two poems that help create a sense of the backdrop for POC's entry into hip-hop. And on that note, any closing sentiments, remarks at this point? Gestures of refusal?
I just want to say thank you very much. Thank you very much for attending. Thanks for the interest. I never thought that such a deep academic approach would be taken on this culture, hip hop. And I'm sitting over here now, you know, somebody at just a punk school on a regular basis, and I'm getting all my and now understand the value of having, you know, a higher level of education. So Adam, thank you very much, and thank you very much to the audience.
Thank you. Hopefully I'll see some of you tomorrow. Thanks for your indulgence. Can I just remember me? I'd like to.